Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm going to be talking about markets and the arts of attachments with two of the editors of the book, Joe DeVille and Liz McFall. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave.
This is a really interesting book, and I wanted to get you to talk about it with me for a couple of reasons. The first is obviously the content, but it's part of a much broader intellectual project, which I think is quite kind of interesting and, you know, is something that would be well worth thinking about. So before we kind of get into those two big questions, it'd be good to let the listeners know a little bit about yourselves. Obviously, this is the second time you've been on the podcast, first time with an edited book. But if you could just kind of say a little bit about your academic backgrounds and the kind of things you've been working on. Maybe start, Liz.
Yeah, okay. So I always find it kind of struggle, given that I've got a very interdisciplinary or mongrel background. So I always kind of struggle to really precisely name my field. In some fundamental ways, I kind of think of my project as being about the sociology of translation, because I'm concerned with trying to make sense across a number of interdisciplinary fields of kind of big questions about how culture and economy, material, technique, practice and sentiment are connected and how they work together. And for me, that's generally centred around the question of markets and market attachment. How is it that markets work to lure people in, particularly for dull and difficult products? So it's very easy to talk about the marketing of Coca-Cola or the marketing of Nike or the marketing of Taylor Swift. It's easy to think about people's desire being excited by those kinds of propositions. It's much harder to think about how desire and attachment, more specifically, is produced for products like industrial insurance, health insurance, or in Joe's case, we work together quite a bit, in terms of debtor relationships. So how are those kinds of forms of attachment that are mediated through markets engineered, and how are people involved in them?
Yeah, I think, you know, we share many interests. You know, we've co-authored a chapter in this book and have worked on a number of projects together. So I think in that respect, I think I share a lot with what Liz just outlined. I guess one of my commitments, I think this is also reflected in Liz's work, is to, when it comes to questions of finance and the economy, to really tie together and seek to trace the connections that tie together the really intimate world of domestic life and the often seemingly more abstract world, but nonetheless very, in some ways, very intimate also, actually, world of organisational life. So how financial processes move from the household to the organisation and from the organisation back to the household as mediated by a range of technologies, devices, affects and processes and so on. A lot of my work, as Liz mentioned, is focused on debt. So last time I spoke to you, I was talking about my book, which was Lived Economies of Default, which looked at debt defaults, so the situation where people are unable to repay their debts, and particularly focused on the work of debt collection. So again, they're tracing both the kind of lived experience of a default, so what it actually means and how what it feels like to encounter the routine prompt of the debt collector, and actually going into organisations and looking at how they go about the work of trying to extract as much value as they can from people who are defaulting on their debts.
Yeah, and these kind of themes are really present in this book, Markets and the Arts of Attachment. And I guess, Liz, you've kind of alluded to this, and again, it's come up in what you've just been saying, Joe, but, you know, this is part of a much bigger moment in British social science. And the book series, Culture, Economy and Social, is a reflection of this. And I think were both of your books published as part of that book series?
That's right, I think both of our books.
So I wonder if you could say a bit about that series as a way of kind of introducing some of the themes that are in Markets and the Arts of Attachment.
Yeah, sure. So Cultural Economy and Social book series is a book series that came out of a major ESRC-funded researcher, a major ESRC-funded research centre called CRESC, the Centre for Research into Social and Cultural Change, which ran for 10 years, finishing in 2014, and was shared by the Open University and Manchester University. And these questions about, well, how do we make sense of social and cultural change, particularly when we enter the new millennium, seemed really significant, and particularly in terms of the fact that sociologists and social scientists talk about social change all the time, but we don't ever actually pin down what we mean by it. Now, Kresk decided that it was going to be time-limited, you know, it was going to run its 10-year lifespan, and it would continue in some minor form after that, but it was going to be time-limited. There were two outcomes that were not to be time-limited. One of them is this book series, Culture, Economy and the Social, and another one is the companion project, the Journal of Cultural Economy. And they, in slightly different ways, are trying to build this interdisciplinary project of mainly social scientists, but not entirely social scientists, not exclusively social scientists, who are concerned really in kind of the understanding the boundaries between culture, economy, and society.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I've always really liked about the series, and I mean, I've been involved, I think it's actually the fourth time I've been involved in a book in the series, so it's not actually necessarily through design, it just kind of ended up that way, but one of the things I've always really liked about this series, I think, is its theoretical openness. So if you look across the whole series, I think you really, it's extremely sort of, it's disciplinarily diverse, as you point towards. I think it's also theoretically diverse. And I think in some respects that sort of is reflected in this book itself. So you can see a range of different influences, disciplinary influences and intellectual influences, which I think in some sense is in keeping with, I guess, the increasing, you know, with the tradition of the series as it is still emerging.
Where did this book come from? What's the kind of process of bringing together this edited collection?
It's great. It's probably one of the slowest edited collections. This is really slow academia. So back in 2011, we won a British Academy grant for a conference called Market Encounters, in which a number of the authors who represented this book were presented at. And that gave rise to a project called Charisma, Consumer Market Studies. And that was partly in reflection on what had by then been about 10 years of dominance by the social studies of finance, which were taking a much needed material and technically focused approach to how finance works, and particularly questions of performativity and questions of how, you know, forms of action are distributed and produced through particular kinds of materials, techniques and forms of knowledge. And the high finance end of that had a lot of attention. And we were concerned, particularly with the way high finance is related to what we call low finance, and that there needs to be forms of, charismatic organisation whereby consumer markets don't work by duping people, but they work by a kind of peculiar form of magic, black box magic, that we've never really got to the bottom of. And we use charisma as a way of trying to say there is something going on here that neither big explanations like material and technical explanations or the simple phrase culture quite gets to. So that was why we use charisma. And this book is the first, it's not the first related product, but it's the first project that publication that comes specifically out of that network.
I think you've alluded to answer this question, but obviously the thing that springs from just the title and the introduction is what is this thing, attachment? What are we actually talking about here? And I guess, you know, how do you use that as a way of accounting for this story of how people get involved, how people, you know, not get conned or duped by marketing, but how they get kind of enrolled in these projects of contemporary consumer capitalism. So yeah, what does attachment mean? What's this term mean?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it sort of signals, I mean, most obviously it signals an interest in relationships, the way in which relationships are built up. And I guess, as Liz just alluded to, thinking with more precision about how those relationships are constructed, how they're maintained, and also sometimes how they fall apart. I think in various ways, that's what the various contributions of this book do. They trace these process of relationship building, involving a varied range of parties, from consumers to marketers, to the various devices and techniques that are involved in, as you say, kind of this seemingly kind of magical process of keeping people attached to markets, so connected to markets, keeping people sometimes passionate about markets. So it's this question of relationality. And then the second kind of aspect of that is then thinking about the ways in which markets are distributed. So thinking about tracing these kind of chains of attachment that connect together various entities in markets, and sometimes exceed the intentions of those who are devising the techniques and technologies of attachment. So I think one of the things a number of chapters in the book do is actually think about those situations when attachments go awry, or people invent new social and technical practices to manage market attachments. Yeah, so I mean, that's partly, I mean, another kind of feature of the book is, I guess, that people inevitably, the writer, the authors, take this sort of turn in a variety of different ways. I think in some sense, each of them kind of explore a different kind of facet of question of attachment. I guess the third point I'd just like to make, I guess, is that, and this is comes through particularly strongly in Frank Cauchois's chapters. Frank Cauchois is the third editor, I should just say, in the book, is that market attachment, so creating the bonds that hold together markets, processes of constructing market attachment, also inevitably construct social relationships. So the kind of conventional argument that markets are an intrusion into the social, that markets destroy social relationships. I think in some sense we're kind of challenging that by thinking the ways in which the techniques and technologies that markets mobilize actually end up constructing new forms of relationality, new forms of connection between people and organizations, have really quite significant social, cultural, economic effects.
So are these the kind of, what term do you use, the arts and devices of attachment then?
So Joe's absolutely right to kind of signal the importance of relationships, the foundational importance of relationships in terms of understanding attachment. So we're not talking about attachment theory in a Bowlby sense, but it is there in the background in terms of this overall and overarching concern with relationships and how they're made. Now, this has a stronger reference back to work in the sociology of translation in the 1990s, in particular the work associated with Antoine Ennion, Genevieve Tell, and Michel Callot, and Bruno Latour. But Ennion in particular has been important in trying to elaborate what he refers to as a grammar of taste. And the way he puts this, and I think it's for me it's really productive, is a curiosity about how an actor has himself love things. And that moment of how do you have yourself get involved in market action is one of the key underlying questions for the book. What is that kind of recursive loop, that kind of recursive action that produces markets? Certainly for me, that relates to questions about devising, questions about not devices per se, which have had a lot of airing, ideas about centering around market devices. This is very related to that project, the idea that there's an assemblage which underpins how action is distributed and how certain consequences come to be. But devising is used to kind of signal the idea that this is a dynamic practice, that human beings are involved in it more than anything. This is not just about what particular technologies and what particular black boxes of knowledge and algorithms or whatever do. This is about the black boxes of dynamic human practice. How is that going on? And how much of it can we render? How much of it can we describe? And how much of it kind of eludes our attempts to describe? And that idea that love and the process of having yourself love, every kind of love is an imaginary love to start with. This idea that have somewhere in what William James calls the private fact of human reasoning, there is this process of having yourself get involved in the world, in the objects, and in the people that surround you.
Yeah, and just quickly, I think that just to sort of extend that a little bit, I think when thinking about these extremely sort of intimate aspects of human relation, of humans, of, you know, of society, one of the things that we're kind of interested in tracing are the ways in which there are all these attempts in market settings to capture some of this kind of intimacy, to capture kind of, you know, so there's one chapter we'll come onto, I'm sure, looks at love explicitly, looks at kind of dating websites and how dating websites go about the business of capturing potential love or sometimes lust. But that there is this kind of inevitable excess, so it becomes very, very difficult. So there's always this kind of attempt to kind of capture this excess. But it's inevitably never sort of complete. So when we sort of think about questions of devising, we're not seeing these as processes that are sort of totalizing and are wholly strategic in a way that is inevitably successful. But in actual fact, thinking about these as co-constructive processes, which you need to pay attention both to what's going on at an organizational level and what organizations that claim they're doing, and on the other hand, looking actually what happens when these devices actually encounter, as you say, the kind of dirt and the private fact of everyday life, and things get complex. It becomes something very difficult to actually to attribute metrics to these processes, to objectify these processes in some way. And sometimes, I mean, so in our chapter, which again we'll come on to, these processes of devising fail, because organizations are sometimes quite bad at actually understanding the multiplicity of attachments that are actually involved in relation to a particular product, in relation to a particular service.
I mean, yeah, if you kind of hold that thought, because I think before we come into the specific work you do in your own chapter, it'd be good to get, I guess, a practical example of the kinds of things we've been talking about. And I mean, the best way I've thought to phrase this is, do you love your Apple Watch? Because the introduction uses the example of one of the authors and her Apple Watch. So,
yeah.
I wonder who that could be.
So this was clearly me. Joe is quite, I think ambivalent would be putting it mildly. He's not an Apple fan. And Frank is more ambivalent about Apple. But the Apple Watch story is about my relationship with the Apple Watch, which coincidentally broke just yesterday. It lasted detached now. It lasted nearly 2 years, but I am probably later today going to replace it because I feel lost without it. And that is quite an interesting thing in itself, in that my arm is now there. I'm not feeling... I'm not thinking about this in a Donna Haraway cyborg kind of way, but the watch has become part of my arm, part of my daily practice, part of the way that I connect with the world. You know, obviously I look at it as a watch, but I'm also constantly monitoring my movement. It was crucial to me, and I was training for a race recently, and it was crucial for me to do that. But in minor practical ways, it buzzes when it's going to rain. It taps me on the arm if my children are trying to get in touch with me. And it includes these... one of my favourite features is it gives me the ability to ping my phone. And now if I lose my phone, I've got no idea and no mechanism for figuring out where it is. So in these practical ways, it sort of organises my relationships with my other devices and my relationships with the people in my life and my general relationships with the weather, the world, and outcomes I'm attached to. So I was very interested in how that was orchestrated. And one of the things to talk about when I talk about it in the introduction is it's much more attractive than a Fitbit. I don't really feel like I have to hide it. I'm not embarrassed by its ugliness. It's not so super functional looking. And there's something that in another work, which is particularly focused on self-tracking, that we're interested in is the importance of sensory and ambient interfaces in the watch, the watch is much more sentient and ambient in terms of how it displays action to you, and how it addicts, you know, to return to broader themes of the book, we have this concern with devices that addict you in terms of producing particular forms of practice. And there is that. There's something addictive about closing the three rings of activity monitoring on the watch.
Yeah, it's not just an attachment to your wrist. It's, you know, a kind of, you get enrolled entirely in kind of like the project of being an Apple Watch wearer.
Yeah.
But I guess the key thing is that this is, you know, as Natasha Dalshall, you know, write about her book, this is addiction by design. This is a kind of co-construction of design and this particular way that you, for whatever reasons, interact with the various affordances and, you know, forms of beauty that Apple put on display, that for whatever reason you find very attractive and attaching.
But also, I guess the kind of like the final moment with the introduction is the very first thing you say is that this is not a process of essentially kind of like conning you into being an Apple Watch owner. You know, it's kind of that almost kind of old school, I guess, you know, kind of Marxist critical theoretical framework of, you know, these people are idiots, they've been conned by marketing. That really isn't where the book starts at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think the three of us as editors and the authors probably all have somewhat different views on this. For me, the addiction by design argument doesn't quite work. It's very persuasive. Natasha Dalshall's book on machine gambling and how machine gambling is engineered in very particular ways to produce addiction. You know, that's a fantastic account, but for me it doesn't quite get there one of the most simple logical reasons it doesn't quite get there is that some people will use these machines and develop this dependent relationship and other people won't. And to return back to the idea of having oneself love things, one of the things we wanted to do was get into, well, what is the individual human being doing? How do we understand them? If we don't understand them as mute and dumb ciphers of capitalist structuralist arrangements or neoliberal governmentality or however you want to phrase what Lacanians would call the big other, you need to kind of take seriously what we are doing when we get involved in that grammar of taste. It's not a question of connecting these two things. It's actually understanding how they are always connected. They're only separated because we make them so.
Yeah, and also just to connect, I mean, I agree very much with everything you just said. I mean, I think that part of what I've always been interested to do in my work, I think part of what this book also does is thinking about the way in which market attachments are inevitably wrapped up with a variety of other forms of attachment. And the two sort of interface with one another, and the two affect and shape each other in a variety of different ways. So I think in some of the work on market attachment, we kind of misses out, I guess, these other forms of attachment people have to each other, to one another, in friendship groups and familial groups. So some of our chapters go on to talk about online communities and so on, and thinking about the ways in which markets actually kind of interact with these other forms of attachment. They try and shape them, inevitably. They're constantly trying to interact and intervene in them in various ways. But of course, it's a two-way relationship. These kind of other forms of attachment end up sort of shaping market attachment. I think in some of the kind of accounts of market attachment, and perhaps in Natasha's book as well, some of these other processes and forms of relationality that, you know, exceed the space of the market, exceed the casino, aren't really accounted for.
I mean, stop me if I'm jumping around too much, but as you were describing that, the thing that springs to mind are two chapters. One that talks about social media marketing, and the other that talks about consumer research in advertising. And I wonder, actually, if we might talk a little bit about those.
Right. So the chapter by Thomas Aritzia in the book is quite an interesting one because he's looking at consumer research and advertising agencies based on ethnographic work that he did. But the thing that's fundamentally interesting in terms of the thematic of the whole book is the way in which he describes how this elusive object, the consumer truth about a product, is sought by the advertising agency. But in being sought by the advertising agency, it's produced by the advertising agency. And this, again, goes back to a longer legacy of thinking about how the relationships between consumers and their products are engineered and distributed around a crowd of intermediaries whose job it is to figure out how products are already a potency, a potentiality within people. So in some senses, there's a whole range of technical actions, specialist practices that go into putting products into people from the very start. And this is something you can also see in the social media market.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, this is Kevin Millais' chapter, which again, so very much like Thomas's chapter, does the work, which I think really is not done enough in social science and in economic sociology, broadly speaking, of rather than just taking marketing practices at their word or looking at what happens when they kind of end up out in the world and we can all observe them, actually going behind the scenes, going into the agencies that are involved in these various technologies of attachment. In this particular chapter's case, it's kind of interesting. So it actually draws on data from around 2008, 2009. So in some ways, it's a kind of historical chapter now because it's looking at social media marketing in its earlier days. But in what I think is why that makes it, I think, particularly an interesting case, because you can see the emergence of logics that have become increasingly intensified recently, but in their formative phase. You can see this concern with attempting to... So one of the kind of things he looks at is the attempt to achieve contagion, the attempt to achieve virality. So how to make a video, how to make it go viral. And you can see this is something that clients are absolutely obsessed with. This is the kind of holy grail of marketing to for individuals, for communities, for quite often plenty disconnected communities to effectively do the work of marketing for you. Now, of course, this is the holy grail, but it's incredibly difficult to achieve. And it's also incredibly difficult for a marketing agency to claim that they're able to achieve it based on, you know, they'll try and mobilize their past record. They'll try and look back at those cases when they have been successful. But what clients want is predictability. So what the chapter kind of documents is this kind of inevitable tension to kind of harness this indefinable something that exists out there in the world, which marketers themselves don't fully understand, but are desperate to tap into, and to try and metricize that, to try and quantify that, to try and objectify it in some way, and to develop a variety of techniques to do so. But on the other hand, what I think it really captures is the real difficulty of doing so. You know, often in kind of sociological accounts, you get the sense that marketers are kind of all powerful and kind of omnipotent. And it, once you're actually going to go behind the scenes, you actually see some of the weaknesses in some ways of marketing, or let's just say maybe not the weaknesses but the struggles that are going on behind the scenes to kind of achieve these effects. And one of the things I think is interesting, and it kind of connects to a number of other chapters we may come on to talk about as well, is the attempt also then to harness things like existing online communities. How do you go about harnessing these existing communities that exist online? How do you track those who have influence? How do you, you know, what data can you produce about those who have influence? How do you actually start to measure influence? How do you start to measure contagion? Which I think are very much themes that flow through the book.
Yeah, and I guess immediately these kind of struggles and these kind of, you know, harnessing projects are given really kind of concrete examples with Dove and American Apparel in Carolyn Gerlitz's chapter. You know, where those two companies had these, you know, kind of, I suppose, were used to these modes of advertising now, but, you know, slightly unusual approaches. So it'd be interesting to hear a little bit of your kind of take on those two examples.
I mean, what Carolyn, I think, really nicely captures, I mean, so the two cases she considers, yeah, as you say, Dove and American Apparel, are both brands that seek to associate themselves not just with particular functional benefits, but with particular sort of social concerns, societal concerns, societal causes, particularly issues of bodies and bodily experience. So, for instance, you focus on this kind of Dove campaign for real beauty, which I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with, that sought to kind of, on the face of it anyway, sought to challenge dominant body norms and so on. She draws on focus groups with women thinking about how these brands have or have not succeeded in attaching themselves to their lives, and in particular then thinking about how these brands succeed or not in becoming enmeshed in the broader kind of circuits of conversation and correlation that exist between people. So, I mean, I think one of the things that Dove has in some sense, or she argues has kind of achieved, is to kind of insert itself as a point, and so in the conversation between people about what bodily norms might or might not be. American Apparel is particularly interesting because, so she again looks at the kind of particular aesthetic of American Apparel and how it's in its case sought to attach itself to this kind of hipster kind of Shoreditch kind of lifestyle. But on the other hand, again, we kind of see that the operations of attachment kind of go rogue. She looks at people's Flickr posts where people post up images, often wearing American Apparel clothes, but sometimes wearing completely different clothes. But, you know, for instance, hashtags, you know, this is an American Apparel look. So on the one hand, you see people in some sense doing the kind of work of branding for the marketers. But on the other hand, you see the brand kind of becoming something beyond just the products to incorporate a much wider set of practices and concerns. And as in many other chapters, and again, to bring us to the overall theme thematics of the book, I think one of the things she's very, very keen on tracing, and I very much subscribe to this, is that to understand these processes of attachment, you need to attend to what she calls the multivalence of attachment. That attachments operate across a variety of different registers and enroll a variety of different actors.
I mean, there's lots and lots kind of more I could ask you about. And like the book is, you know, really kind of rich. You mentioned there's a chapter on online dating. There's a chapter about the kind of process of how kind of call centers function as enrolling and attaching mm-hmm. people. But I'd like to spend a bit of time talking about, I guess, kind of, you know, low finance or, you know, everyday finance, because several of the chapters in the book, and I guess, you know, the kind of the things that come up in your work are really concerned with that. And there's, you know, there's a couple of things we could think about there, how, you know, credit card companies kind of, you know, make consumers you know, how kind of everyday consumer finance functions. But I wonder if we might kind of approach this more theoretically. And one of the things that you do in your chapter is engage with a theorist who's become, you know, really kind of influential and important in British social science, Gabriel Tarde. And it'd be interesting to know kind of where that theoretical kind of lineage gets us to when we're thinking about everyday finance and the kind of, yeah. I quite like the term low finance, even though it probably isn't correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're reclaiming it.
So I'd like to kind of start into that question, because it's a really important one for the book and for that whole project. Now, one of the things that runs through the book is the sort of tension between the arts and devices of markets. And Michel Callon's written a really wonderful afterword to the book, in which he describes three different sorts of devices. Devices of addiction, we mentioned earlier, devices of co-production, but also devices of conversation. Now, that's really important for Joe and I in particular, that notion of conversation as being central to the relationship between consumers and their products, but especially when you think about low finance. So if we said earlier that we were interested in the relation, how really quite difficult and dull products are managed, rather than the very obvious ones where you can talk about glamour and the excitement. So what about those things that people really don't want to buy? How do you engineer a relationship that lasts, you know, in some cases, an enduring intergenerational relationship between quite poor consumers, quite poor customers, and financial companies? And one of the case studies that's used in our chapter is that of industrial insurance, which was a form of insurance for the poor, which was sold by agents collecting small premiums on a weekly basis door to door. Now, conversation was absolutely at the heart of that exchange. The agent was drawn from the communities they served, but was kind of schooled and trained and cultivated in very particular ways to be what I've called before a good average, in the sense that they could fit in every home and they kind of knew how to listen and to speak to customers, but particularly to listen and gather. What was, you know, this was a massive market. In the UK, you're talking about 70 million policies in existence in the 1940s. So they were sweeping up the data based on these conversations. Now, Gabrielle Tard, to go back to your question, made a very explicit point of saying that in markets, producers and consumers never meet except through the mechanism of conversation. So that exchange and that dialogue between people and producers, consumers and producers, people in their markets is absolutely integral. He says at one point, 1,000 advertising trumpets would trump in vain if it wasn't for the art of conversation. And these agents were absolutely fundamental, and they were bureaucratically organized in a way to make conversation, an art and a device of how markets operated. And in that chapter, we look at that historical market, the historical low finance market, but we then compare it with Wonga, a very controversial low finance product from recent times.
Yeah, and then what's really interesting there is that you have conversation and listening moving into a different register, which is the register of data and sort of big data, effectively, where Wonga, for those of the listeners that don't know, I mean, Wonga is a payday loan company. It's a very controversial payday loan company, but it likes to see itself probably primarily, or certainly in the past, anyway, has claimed that it is primarily a tech company, and claims to be able to make predictions about the creditworthiness of individuals based on a much wider range of data than is conventional in the credit market. So what happens here is you have this movement of conversation and listening, movement from it being face-to-face, happening on the doorsteps and the thresholds of people's homes, to the way in which people engage with its websites, the various forms of the various signals that one can detect in a variety of forms of data that they're able to gather and they're able to access. And I think it's one of the things that our chapter does is looking at the way in which there are commonalities in these processes. You know, we need to understand these data-oriented processes of market attachment as, in actual fact, conversational and as involving listening. So I think, you know, the section Wonga is subtitled The Art of Listening. Wonga is and has been extremely successful in listening to its customers. You know, it for a time before the payday loan, the cap on interest came in, for a time it was by far the most expensive payday lender in the UK, and yet it succeeded in becoming, from a position when it was, you know, third or fourth, to becoming the largest payday lender in the UK, which is quite astonishing given the extreme cost of its product. The way it was able to do that was because it was very good at understanding its customers well. Of course, this is also tied into their various marketing practices and so on, but they were very good at understanding who its customers were and how to attach them, and crucially how to keep them attached, which it does in a variety of ways, which I haven't time to go into now. So that's part of what we do. And just very quickly, what we also trace in the chapter is the way that these processes actually can sometimes break down. Wonga was very successful, but what it didn't fully understand was its attachment. And again, here I draw on this kind of notion of wider attachments, or attachments that exceed the market, to public controversy, to the public mood, which increasingly turned against it, and actually to the power of regulation to constrain its activities.
So that argument is quite an interesting one in terms of returning to the question about how people have themselves loved things, and that is particularly puzzling in terms of finance markets, consumer finance markets, because the finances, it's a vehicle to something else. It's not direct, you know, people don't want the finance. They want finance for their means to achieve something else that they love. So industrial assurance, in a way, was based on familial attachment, in the sense that the outcome people wanted to achieve when they took a policy out was the decent burial, initially the decent burial. Subsequently, other things, like a substantial sum to achieve other, still primarily familial things like weddings and anniversary parties and big holidays as the 20th century went on. But the insurance company, when they were doing all those, when the agents were doing the talking, they were listening to what it was that people loved and cared about and able to code, and you can see this in the marketing and in the advertising campaigns, enable to encode those outcomes in the understanding of the policy. Now, that's quite different when Wonga do it, but it also has parallels. What is it that Wonga was listening to? What was it that Wonga was getting to understand about what its consumers wanted? And I think the consumers, in some ways, you know, in data, as Joe would explain, is difficult to get because Wonga are not actually really giving it away about who their customer base are and what they know about them. We know that they swept up lots and lots of data points based on web browsing behaviour and Facebook profiles and so forth to get a sense of who the customers were. But, you know, a sort of not entirely serious guess, what Wonga's customers were wanting was to go out. They wanted to go out at the weekend. They wanted to buy, you know, to buy things so that they were well-dressed at the weekend. So there's a kind of social outcome at the end of that that the financial intermediary company is trying to understand and trying to say, well, we are the mechanism for that. And you can also read that in Wonga advertising that it's got controversially a light, crazy, you know, granny scratching vinyl vibe about it. So, yeah, we're crazy, we're having fun. It's fine to get into debt because, you know, having fun is more important.
Well, they tried to rebrand themselves recently. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was it.
I mean, you talk about, you know, love and, you know, our finance example as being a means to something else. And I wonder if we can kind of conclude with the penultimate chapter in the book, which is the simple story of a man's love for a classic car. And I mean, you don't need to say too much about this because one of the things I like about this chapter is, like, it's really clearly an autoethnographic account. So it's really unfair to kind of say to the editors, you know, explain somebody else's story. But it's quite nice in a way because, as I say, you know, we've kind of scratched the surface of the book, but this chapter stood out, I think, from the others because it is quite different. And, you know, there's stories about companies in there, but it's really, you know, kind of the story of, like, a classic middle-aged man's project and how he becomes attached to a classic car.
Well, Hans Schielberg, whose chapter this is of course, eternally young. I think he may be kept eternally young by his love affair with the Thunderbird, which is a very beautiful car.
It is. Yeah, the photographs are great.
And, you know, what that chapter details is, yeah, it is an explicit case study in how you have yourself love something. And in Hans's case, how you have yourself love something through this incredibly long and enduring process of care and nurture. And how that is a technical and material and distributed process. You know, if you geolocated all the parts that went into the reconstruction of this car, this beautiful Thunderbird, you know, you would be stretching all over the world. And also the parts and tooling the parts. So Hans talks about the way in which he sort of re-engineers screws that are no longer available because he doesn't have to get the car working. He has to get the car to its ideal original. And that is this is practice, but there's also something involved there that even words like love are not quite getting to in terms of rendering. What is this about? And at some fundamental level, this is what products and markets do. I mean, our chapter is called The Market Will Have You, and it is fundamentally based on this conceit, this argument, that what the market is doing in putting products out there is they're putting products out there that assemble ourselves. It's through our relationships, and this is a Tardian point as well, it's through human being, we might be more accurately characterized as human having. We are what we are. We acquire our identities. Stuart Hall once says identity is always a matter of becoming as well as of being. So Hans's chapter in all sorts of ways describes this kind of technical, material, symbolic, emotional process of building relationships with objects and things in order to become ourselves.
Hopefully that's given a sense of kind of the richness of the book and the different chapters as well as its kind of major theoretical contribution. it's always a bit mean to kind of say to authors, so what comes next? But what comes next? What are you working on at the moment?
I'm taking this kind of interest in data in various ways. So I'm thinking very interested in what happens, how we might think about publics in relation to data, how data might constitute certain forms of collectivity that they perhaps are aware of and that they're not aware of. That's kind of one issue that I'm thinking about. I'm also kind of moving to research on tax. So thinking about this, how this very dry thing we call taxation, again, sort of similarly, how in actual fact, practice of taxation go about the business of keeping people attached to not necessarily markets in this case, but actually just states. So how states produce what I call fiscal consent.
So my bigger project, and it's hinted at in the introduction of the book, is to do with the role of these devices, wearable devices and self-tracking, and the role of big data, and particularly the claim that big data changes the way we know ourselves, that big data will provide a form of knowledge about ourselves and our action that will fundamentally alter the self, so that the technology has us in this kind of really fundamental way. The self is on the wane. We are becoming products, the outcomes of neoliberal capitalism, where everything, all our moods are monitored and all our actions are controlled. For me, in terms of thinking about, well, what is this claim? Can big data, can these new personalized technologies really change the nature of ourselves? And if you think about the fundamental question about, well, are we ourselves through what we have? For me, there's a deep and radical contingency always about the shapes and forms of identity. And it's not that nothing ever changes structurally, it's like things change all the time. So how can you get to, you know, epochal moments of change that are different?
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Joe Deville and Elizabeth Fall, who are two of the editors of Markets and the Arts of Attachment, which was published by Routledge in 2017.